So tonight I want to talk about Pattaka Samuppada, usually translated as dependent origination. So I would suggest that if your Aunt Nellie asks you to explain this Buddhism business, do not start with dependent origination. She will have you committed. Now, most of you have heard at least something about dependent origination before. Many of you know a lot about it. And it's a huge topic. There's no way I could possibly do it justice. I've been to day-longs where I felt that they just touched the surface of it. So I'm really going to try to touch on a couple of unusual approaches or look at it from a couple of different angles. Hopefully, I'll be able to bring something new to your understanding of this topic. But I find to do that, one still has to sort of make sure that we start in the same place. So I am going to do some review, fairly basic and unbelievably rapid. So the Wheel of Life, this is a tour of the Wheel of Life or Bhava Chakra mandala. And you see this throughout the Vajrayana world, Tibet, Bhutan, Nepal. You see it in the Indian regions of Ladakh, Sikkim, and Darjeeling. You also see it in Chinese regions near Tibet and in Mongolia, which might surprise you. Mongolia is a Vajrayana nation. And you will see one of these on our dining room wall. It's a souvenir from Gangtok, Sikkim. And it is a tourist version, and I'll explain what that means later. It's on display in public areas of monasteries, so courtyards, entryways. And the reason for this is that they are an educational image. It's aimed at lay people. And if you go to a place like Bhutan and ask anybody in the street what this all means, they could probably give you a pretty good description of the iconography in this image. So it's a big circle or disc, actually, held in Yama's grip. Yama is the god of death. Now, there are a few places where they say it's somebody else, but most places say it's Yama. And there are four concentric circles. This inner one, this one here, this big one here, and then the outer one. So let's take a look at them. A little bit of a detour here. The inmost circle is our old friend, the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. Interestingly, the rooster is greed. Here in the West, we think of pigs as greedy. No, pigs get a bad rap here. So the rooster is greed, the snake is anger, and the pig is delusion or ignorance. And the next circle out is the intermediate state, or the white path and dark path. There are people going up on the left, looking pretty happy and dressed very nicely and looking well-fed. People on the right-hand side descending, looking quite unhappy and brandishing weapons and looking hungry. So it's just a reminder that what goes up comes down. You might be living a high life right now, but at some point in the future, this is going to come to an end and things are going to look bleak again, and vice versa. Things are always changing. Don't get too caught up on where you are. So the next circle out are these six sections. And these are the six realms of existence. This first one is human realm. It's got pictures of people farming or herding animals or making things or selling things or just hanging out or talking. The next one is the animal realm. The ancients did not have a very sentimental view of animal life. They considered it to be kind of dog-eat-dog. I like this one. Next one is the realm of the hungry ghosts. The hungry ghosts have big mouths and huge stomachs and little long skinny necks. And the long skinny neck means that they're never able to eat enough to satisfy them. So they always have a voracious, unsatisfied appetite. And I kind of like this because it reminds me of our modern world of consumerism. We watch television in order to find out how much more we need that we don't have. And then there's the hell realms. Now, this is very scary stuff in the authentic paintings of the Wheel of Life. It usually involves fire and or ice. And it's stuff that you don't want to look at twice or think much about. They're pretty gruesome. And the tourist versions like ours are really toned down. Version on the dining room wall here is really more of a realm of mild discomfort. Then there is the realm of the jealous gods. Now, the jealous gods really have it pretty well off. They're well fed. They should be happy. They live for eons. But no, they're jealous of the other gods, the god gods. And these gods are just having a grand old time. They're hanging out. Most of the images have a picture of a musician. So they sit around listening to music and drinking, and, you know, it's great. But what they don't know is that this stuff doesn't last. They might be in this god realm for eons, but sooner or later, they're going to fall back out of it into some lesser realm. So now we go to the outmost circle, and that's the one we're interested in here. Yes, we've taken a little bit of a detour, but I just like the circle of life. And this is an illustration of the 12 links of dependent origination. So dependent origination is a concept that is common with lay people even throughout the Vajrayana regions. That's how important it is, both to us and to that lineage, and to other lineages. So, by the way, going back to the realms of existence, in every one of these realms, usually there's an image of the Buddha offering his compassion and showing a path out of this cycle. So, dependent origination, Paticca-samuppada, which I'm sure that I'm mispronouncing, sorry. The first link, the first step, the very beginning, the foundation is avijja, ignorance, or lack of knowledge. And it's symbolized by a blind person trying to walk. And the second link is sankhara, usually described as volitional impulses or formation of karma. Volitional impulses meaning that this is where there's a first sense of being able to choose. Shown is a potter shaping a bowl or a cup. The next link, the third one, is vijnana, or consciousness. And this is symbolized by a man or a monkey, which shows consciousness which tends to spring uncontrolled from object to object. We've all talked about monkey mind. Well, this is the monkey that represents monkey mind. And the next one is nama-rupa, which is symbolized by two men afloat in a boat, sometimes by three or five or one, not sure the different iconography there. Now, this is interesting. Nama-rupa is often translated as mentality and materiality, which I find very awkward. It's literally name and form, nama, name, rupa, form. So what's going on here? There's a lot. I'm going to read a short quote from Samyutta Nikaya 12.2. This is the Buddha speaking. And what, monks, is name and form? Feeling, perception, intention, contact, and attention. This is called name. The four great elements and the form dependent on the four great elements, this is called form. This name and this form are, monks, called name and form. So there's five nama factors in nama rupa. And they resemble, at first at least, the five aggregates. There's contact, vedana, that is pleasant and unpleasant, and neutral, and perception. And then there's intention, the volitional realm, the capacity for choice. We can't have intention unless we know that we could have non-intention. And then the fifth of the nama elements is intention. This is the, attention. This is the ability to focus attention. Now, these five factors are said by Stephen Batchelor to be necessary components of consciousness, but perhaps not sufficient. Just like five fingers are necessary for a healthy hand, but you can't just take five fingers and call it a hand. The rupa factors are our old friends earth, air, fire, and water. Stephen Batchelor says that nama rupa is what lets you look in the mirror and recognize who it is. I once saw Stephen Batchelor give a one-hour talk on nama rupa. So, and it's a fascinating topic, and we're going to get back to this. I'm harping on this because it's an important point that'll come back later. The next of the steps is salayatana, the six senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And this is shown by a dwelling with six windows as the six sense gates. And the next link is pasa, contact, where object, sense organ, and sense consciousness all meet. Contact with something in the exterior world. And this is represented by lovers kissing and hugging. The next link is vedana, or pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And this is represented by a person with an arrow or a thorn in the eye, showing the impact of vedana. It's a big deal. By the way, the arrow does not appear in the tourist versions. You will not get this in your souvenir tanka. And the next is tanha. The vedana, the pleasant, the unpleasant, or the neutral, leads us into thirst or craving, represented by a drinker getting a drink. And this is where we are first aware that we want to get, or we want to avoid. The vedana goes by so quickly, it's almost like it's built into the contact. We don't really notice the step, but tanha is where we become aware of wanting. Next is upadana, grasping or sensual entanglement, shown by a monkey or a man picking fruit. And this is where we start to identify with the wanting, where it starts to get to be a bigger deal. And a number of these steps really sort of represent the wanting getting more ramified. Then we come to bhava, or coming to be, usually but not always represented by a couple engaged in sex. Next we have jati, or birth, being born, shown by a woman giving birth. And then jara marana, old age and death, with a corpse being carried, and this being probably Tibet or one of the Himalayan worlds, those are the vultures there, because corpses there are set out to be exposed. So these are the links showing the cycle of suffering. And it's a breakdown of how we fire the second arrow. That is, it's pointing out step by step how we create our own suffering. And most of you are aware of, already know, and even use Second Arrow in your practice. The Second Arrow is what we do to add to stress. Now, the First Arrow is stuff that happens to us. Just briefly, we stub our toe, we lose a loved one, we get laid off from work. Bad things happen. And the Second Arrow is what we add to the story. And some recent research, very interesting research, shows that something like 80%, for people suffering from chronic pain, 80% of the perceived pain is actually this Second Arrow. The worrying, the fretting, the stories that we tell, the added stress. And of course, we add stress to the good things that happen too. There's always some Second Arrow. So this whole cycle is a way we have, it's a deconstruction of how we fire that Second Arrow. This cycle is often taught as being lifetime to lifetime. That is, the first steps are from a past life, ignorance and mental formations. Then there's a whole set of stuff that's from our current lifetime. And then birth and aging and death are some future life. It's taught in Tibet, for instance, that to unwind this, to become enlightened, the fast track to it, the quick and dirty way to do it, takes three lifetimes. But Lee Brazington, and Lee Brazington, by the way, has a lot of very interesting stuff on his website about dependent origination. I recommend checking it out. And he points out that there's some logical problems with this, and I won't go into detail. And I think it's more useful to consider this 12 steps as being something that happens moment to moment. That we can have ignorance develop all the way and run through to aging and death momentarily or in a longer sequence. Maybe I'm walking down the street and I see a drum set in the window of a shop and I think, oh, that's a nice looking drum set. Oh, and they're Ludwigs and I like the way they sound and I would look good and I'd sound good if I owned that set. I really want that set. I deserve that set. Oh, but I don't really have any place to put it, and I have to sell my old set, and my band isn't even rehearsing now, and there are no gigs, so, oh boy, that self just died. So these processes can happen a lot, and it could be many wheels at once, some large, some small, most of them overlapping. There are all these little ways where we're recreating suffering all at once. Some of them might take place over days or even weeks. Some of them will take place momentarily. There are incomplete cycles where simply we don't have enough energy to make it through all the way. Now, this moment-to-moment teaching is not just some New Age California gloss. The Abhidhamma teaches it this way. So this goes way, way back. It's worth pointing out that there are some transcendental dependent origination suttas, several, with several different structures. Some go in the opposite direction of the 12 links that we just showed. Some of them have causal change that are quite different from the group that we've just been looking at. Aya Sobhana gave a really nice talk on dependent origination, one of the transcendental modes last week. I recommend going and listening to it. I'm not going to go into any of these tonight because I could easily spend a couple of hours on these. As I pointed out, there's a division between elements of the past, the present, and the future. There are past elements that are conditions that are leading to the present moment. Things that we don't really have control over in the present. And then the present points where we can actually choose, where we have volition, where we have options. And then the future, which is the outcome from our choice. And there are different places where people will divide these up. You know, ignorance and the nama-rupa and things like that are clearly things that are sort of already set up for you. don't have a lot of control over them right now. And then there's the contact. This is what's going on right now. The contact, the fading, the craving, the grasping. So here's a practice point, a way of practicing with this. So we can't change the past now, but it's important to realize that we can change conditions for future cycles running through this spin of the wheel. Future spins of the wheel can change. So this is a good way, thinking of it like this, it's a good way to work with afflictive habitual actions. This habitual action can really look like spinning of the wheel. So rather than despair over an unskillful action, we can start to use mindfulness to recondition future spins of the wheel. And kicking ourselves sometimes for having screwed up in the past may be a valid first step, but long term, it doesn't really get you anywhere. So here's an example. I've told this story before. I used to have a habit I had this way of doing cruel witticisms. I would put people down in kind of biting, sarcastic ways. And I was causing harm. And at first I would sort of deny it. I'd say, oh, you're being too thin-skinned. Oh, come on, don't you have a sense of humor? I started to realize that this wasn't really funny. This was harmful. And I had enough therapy to know that I was acting out old anger, that it was an old survival mode. Being clever was one of the ways that I got through being an undersized child and dealing with bullies. So once I started recognizing that I had an issue, I started to notice how this would come up and how I would say something mean, and then I'd feel bad about it, and I'd see the result. And so I paid more and more attention to it and got more and more aware of how this sequence worked, how this wheel was spinning, how it was working out. And eventually I could see the gap between the, as we've heard from some convicts who've been here, find the gap between anger and violence, or the gap between craving and using, or for me, the gap between that wanting to say something mean and just refraining from it. And the first time that I was able to refrain from it, it was an enormously liberating sensation. It was a wonderful thing. And I didn't realize at the time that what I was doing was reconditioning the wheel. Each time I went back through the wheel, I had subtly changed the conditions, the past that led up to the place where I actually had volition. And eventually I was able to act out of my higher intentions rather than just do automatic pilot. So this kind of approach, looking for the gap or looking to recondition future spins, gives us a lot of leverage for how to change afflictive behaviors. Another practice approach is to look for gaps in larger gaps. And usually it's taught that the gap that you can find is between tanha, thirst or craving, and upadana, grasping or entanglement. Just trying to find my note on these. I mean, desire itself is not in itself bad. We desire good health for our children. We desire more peace in the world. Ajahn Sumedho says that desire is a natural energetic. Can we be mindful of the gap between anger and violence, or between wanting and using? Can we, that big jump between desire and the grasping, starting of identification, where it starts to get complex. Philip Moffat also teaches that it's possible between vedana, pleasant and unpleasant, and desire, or steal from another sutta. If in pleasant there is only the pleasant, if in unpleasant there is only the unpleasant, there's quite a bit of liberation there, if that's possible. And I consider if that's an option for you. Just to step back, the whole thing of dividing the links into the three sections, past, present, and future. This approach does not appear in the suttas, in the discourses, but it does show up in the Visuddhimagga. So it goes back to well before the 4th century AD. And it shows up in Vajrayana too, and in many of the Mahayana lineages. So it's been around for a while. Either this concept of past, present, and future arose in parallel in all these lineages, or more likely, it was in the oral tradition before 250 BC. Again, more stuff on Lee Brazington's site. So there's another approach to dependent origination from Gary Buck. And again, I can't really do this justice. If you get a chance to sit a day long with him, in fact, I should nag him to write a book because there's a lot there. So he treats dependent origination as a way to examine the structures of consciousness. And he also sees each link as a step away from unified consciousness moving into duality. And why that's important, I'll get to in a minute. But he starts with ignorance is sort of the first flash of the possibility of ununified consciousness. And by the second step, formations, there starts to be a differentiation between the known and the knower. By consciousness, step three, there is a polarity. It's still, in a sense, in a unified field, but there is a knowing, as he puts it, knowing and a directional relationship to the known. And by four, nama-rupa, there is a definite gap between what's known and the knowing of it. And he points out, obviously, that by meditation, we can work back towards unity. And in fact, you may have experienced meditational states where the difference between knowing and the known has become far less. Why is this of interest? I will just note advice to Bahia, which is one of the better known of the Buddha's discourses, where a fellow named Bahia comes to nag the Buddha for a quick description of what is enlightenment or how to become enlightened. And the Buddha finally gives up trying to get rid of this guy. And so he says, Bahia, when there is in what is seen only that which is seen, when in that which is heard, there is only that which is heard, and he goes through the rest of the senses, that's enlightenment. Now, some people think that this is that he's doing a deliberate oversimplification to put this guy off. But the discourse says that Bahia was instantly enlightened and just in time because the very next day he was gored by a bull and died. So anyway, Bahia became enlightened. So the sense of being that close to the sense gates where only what is seen is only what is seen, without all of our story, without all of our extra baggage that we attach to it, this is a deep and powerful state. So anyway, I've really kind of butchered Gary Buck's approach to dependent origination. So I've shown 12 links of dependent origination, and that wheel of life mandala that we saw earlier is that we talked about, shows 12 links. But are there 12 links? Actually, some texts list only 10 or 7 or even 6. The Sutta Nipata 4.11 has 7. The Buddha loved causal change and not just for dependent origination. By the way, there's another dependent origination chain in the Digha Nikaya that I don't remember how many links it is, but it's about behaviors. And it starts with Vedana, and it goes to craving and then grasping and a few other things. But it doesn't end in birth and death. It ends in bad things happening, strife and discord. So the Buddha loved causal chains. So I want to take a look here at a source that shows only six links. And this is, I think, a really fascinating text. And it's fascinating to me partly because it's one of the earliest. It's called the Atthakavagga, and I'm not going to try to pronounce that again, or translated as the Book of Eights. And it's translated in a book called The Buddha Before Buddhism by Gil Fronsdale. And I really recommend this. It's an eye-opening book. Now, this Book of Eights is tucked away in a rather obscure place. It's hidden in a larger collection, whose name I don't know, and that is still in one of the Nikayas called the Kudaka Nikaya. Now, we're all familiar with the Majjhima Nikaya, the Digha Nikaya, the Anguttara Nikaya, and the Samyutta Nikaya. But the Kudaka Nikaya, this translates as the minor collection. So already it's sort of shoved to one side, but it's believed to be one of the oldest canonical texts. It's mentioned by name in three other scriptures. And in particular, it's mentioned in the story, well, more than mentioned, there's a story where the Buddha runs into a monk. He's out on the road. He runs into a monk, and the monk is on his way to meet the Buddha. And the Buddha doesn't tell him that he's the Buddha, right? So he asked the monk about the Buddha's teachings, and the monk recites all 16 discourses in the Book of Eights. And the Buddha says, oh, good job, and by the way, I'm the Buddha. And we could take this to mean several things. First of all, that the oral transmission is already underway in the Buddha's lifetime, and the Buddha's checking up on it to see how well it's doing. It also suggests the Book of Eights was assembled very early. It doesn't prove it, but there are a couple of other interesting factors. One is that the language is older and the poetic meter is older than in the later texts. It uses some archaic forms that don't show up. There's no use of the epithet Tathagata, which is what people call the Buddha and what he called himself. He didn't call himself the Buddha. There's almost no use of lists. That's unusual. The Buddha loved his lists. There's no mention of a settled monastic life. So this is probably when the monastics were still moving around. And there's no Four Noble Truths. There's none of the things like the Seven Factors of Enlightenment. There's no Anapanasati. There's no Satipatthana. Now, most of the material, you don't want to read too much into this. Most of the material discusses how monks should behave. A lot of it's just, don't get into arguments. Arguments are a waste of time. Just act like you know what's going on. So it could be treated as just a manual for monastic comportment. It's directed to monastics. It's not directed to lay people. It's not directed to other spiritual seekers like Brahmins or Jains. It's directed towards people who are already followers of the Buddha. So the 11th section in the Book of Eights, out of the 16, is called the Discourse on Quarrels and Disputes, and includes a sequence that I think is dependent origination. Now, Gil Fronsdale does not call this out as dependent origination, but it really jumped out at me. It's certainly a causal chain. And this is the organization, and it's simplified. It starts with Namarupa, which is the foundation of contact. Remember Namarupa, name and form? That which lets you look in the mirror and know who it is? Hey, that's me. So Namarupa leads to contact, that sense contact, where the sense consciousness and the object and the sense organ all meet. Contact is the foundation of Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Vedana is the foundation of desire, familiar so far. Desire is the foundation of what is cherished. I don't have the Pali word for that. What is cherished is the foundation of quarrels and disputes. So this is very interesting. It starts with Namarupa. What's that about? Well, it turns out that there is an Upanishad that was widely known called the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, or the Upanishad of the Great Forest. Widely known in the Buddha's time, it's a Brahminic teaching. The Buddha certainly knew it. A number of his followers certainly did as well. And the format of this discourse is of someone questioning the Buddha. The Buddha uses certain word plays that reference the Great Forest, so scholars think that the questioner is a Brahmin. In the Great Forest Upanishad, Namarupa is the creation of the universe. The universe was undifferentiated chaos until it was perceived and named. Very interesting when you think about it, that the perception of the universe is integral to the existence, to the formation of the universe. This reminds me of the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This is a very mystical concept, and it has so obviously it's arisen in more than one place. It also helps explain this whole business with Namarupa. It helps explain an apparent redundancy. Why contact and Vedna both appear as their own links, but they also show up as part of name and form, as one of the as name factors. This seems like redundancy. And I've read other scholars speculate that a large part of the structure, especially the early part of the 12 links, is political in nature, because the structure would be more easily recognizable to Brahmins and to other people outside of the Buddhist teaching. And this is very typical of the Buddha. He would use known concepts and hijack them. So what can we take from this? What I take from it is that even at the very beginning of his teaching, the Buddha knew dependent origination, or more generally, he knew radical contingency, the interdependence of all phenomena. He had different ways of articulating it, hence the different number of links. This might be the most basic realization of his enlightenment. You know, the Buddha taught for 45 years, and we often treat it as if the entire teachings appeared instantly, and he spent 45 years teaching the same stuff over and over again. And I think that's unlikely, that the Buddha never changed, never learned anything, never developed anything. In fact, there are some early stories that indicate that he was figuring it out as he was on his way to talk to his first five disciples. I won't go into detail. It's one of my favorite stories, but I'll leave that. You've heard me tell it before. So he taught for 45 years, and it may not have sprung forth immediately. He may not have taught about the Four Noble Truths early on. There are some problems with those first suttas where he first teaches about the Four Noble Truths, and I won't go into that, but there are some inconsistencies that lead to some very interesting problems, chronological as well as theological. So the dependent origination also reminds me of process philosophy developed by Whitehead early in the last century. And I'm oversimplifying here also, that he argues that we see the universe, we tend to see it as sort of like billiard balls on a table, stuff that interacts, things. But he argues that it's more about process. It's a bunch of processes going on, which fits in very well with modern physics, which is all about the interaction of energy. For instance, we talk about subatomic particles, but what do we know about them? What we know about them is that we look at them in a cloud chamber. We see the tracks of subatomic particles, maybe. What we're seeing is an event, not a particle. we're seeing a trail of something moving through the cloud chamber. So just what we call subatomic particles, maybe the Buddha saw as earth, air, fire, and water. I don't know. Maybe I smoked too much pot as a teenager. I kind of like that, though. So here's another practice point. When we see this, the world in this way as a set of processes rather than a set of things, then we're seeing anicca, impermanence, in a different way. The arising and passing of things is just a continual flow of energy rather than things popping in and out of existence. And this can be seen experientially, by the way. In meditation, this can be known not conceptually, but experientially. When you see anicca in a different way, this leads to a deeper sense of anatta as well, because we think of ourselves as immutable, permanent objects, objects that think, perhaps, but no, objects nonetheless. And yet, we are changing all the time. And the boundary between us and the rest of the universe is really much more vague than we'd like to think. So back to the 12 links of dependent origination. There are people who argue that you must practice all 12 links to gain any value from the concept of dependent origination. And that's fine. I know people who say that they've experienced all 12 links. And there may be value in looking at all of them. I think one thing to notice is that when you're actually looking at the spins of the wheel of suffering as they're actually happening, it's hard to count all 12 links. In fact, I think it's, I'm forgetting his name. One teacher says that when you're falling out of a tree, you're not going to count the branches as you're falling. You're just going to hit the ground and know you hit a bunch of branches. So you don't have to count all 12 links when you're actually experiencing the recreation, that habitual pattern that you go through over and over again. I think there's underlying truth or underlying truths and underlying practice paths, no matter how many links there are. The links are just a pedagogical device, ultimately. And ultimately, what really makes sense is what works for your practice. So we have time for some questions. If anybody has a question, you can raise your hand, or you can just unmute yourself and hope you don't collide with someone else auditorially. Anyone? You're showing all the symptoms of shock and awe. I don't like that. Okay, Katie, go ahead. Unmute yourself.
It's not a question that's going to make anybody think. I wanted to know the name of that, the one with the six links, the name of that.
It's the 11th discourse, and it's the discourse on, let me see if I can pull this up again. Sorry, I already put my notes away.
Well, you said it like several times, and I just wasn't sure what the word was you were using. It was a short word, not a long one.
Well, it's the Book of Eights is
that, the Book of what?
The Book of Eights.
Like E-I-G-H-T?
Number eight. E-I-G-H-T, right.
The Book of Eights.
I don't know why it's eight. Gil Frunsdale says something about the verse structure. There are 16 discourses in there, so it's not eight discourses. So it may be about the poetic meter. The pieces are mostly in poetry rather than...
And this is an Upanishad?
No, the Upanishad is the Great Forest Upanishad.
Oh, thank you.
If you want to find out more about that, one way to get at least the summary, you could probably look it up online.
My son-in-law will know all about it. He really knows all this stuff.
Although keep in mind that many of these things that were really big time in proto-Hinduism or proto-Vedantism 1,500 years ago may be relatively unknown now. I don't know if original texts for this sutta still exist.
Thank you. Thanks.
Liz?
I'm going to call you Professor Coffin from here on in.
My apologies.
No, it's quite wonderful. I'm very, very impressed with the extent of your knowledge. Seriously, thank you.
I'm good at faking it.
What?
I'm good at faking it.
You're not faking it, kiddo. I know a faker when I see one. You're not. Transcendental dependent origination?
Yes.
What's the difference?
Well,
in two sentences. Yeah.
It's moving towards the ending of suffering. And again, I did not prepare anything on this, and I've seen a number of different treatments. Temple Smith gave a great talk at Sangha, maybe 12, 15 years ago, that I still have notes from.
We should ask him back, by the way. I've been thinking about that.
Yeah. He's hard to get. He is a big shot now, a Dharma big shot, wonderful teacher. And Aya Sudhana last week did give a very good talk, and I do recommend it as one of the approaches to transcendence. Oh, and you can also just Google it. You'll see a bunch of good stuff.
I just wanted to see what you had to say.
Not much at this point.
That's okay. Thank you. Well, you'll come back and talk about it some other time.
Okay. I might pick something easier next time.
Seriously.
Anyone else? Mary.
It's really more of a comment. So our book group is reading Kama and the End of Kama by Ajahn Suchito. And one of the things that really has been striking me about reading this book is it really looks at and talks about aspects of dependent origination, especially the parts about the sankhara that we create and how as you were saying, how meditation is like, it's like, you know, if you're ignorant, then you're blind. It's like, you know, and how you can get to the underlying things to see. And it's kind of like, it's like finding that gap. Sometimes it's seeing the reaction or whatever else is happening and kind of, you know, going back or looking at the emotions that you're having and what's going on. But it was just very interesting that meditation is really good, because it's, for me especially, when you get into a place where you have some kind of stillness of mind, you have at least I feel like I have an opportunity to actually see some of these in kind of slow motion happening out for me. And it's interesting you talking about your habits, and that's the same thing for me. It's just looking at these things and it's such a process of breaking that sankhara, of breaking that habit. It's just not an easy thing to do. But it's nice to know where the places are that right. It's a possibility. I think that's the thing. And meditation is nice because it gives you an opportunity to see maybe where those gaps are for you if you have these reoccurring whatever that comes right. up. So thank you for your talk tonight, especially. It was
really, really good.
It's one of those things for me that I find now what's happening is so much of what I'm learning is starting to fit together very nicely. So the information is like creating this web that hopefully will sit in here for a little bit and then move on down. So thank you.
When you actually are able to use this to break the cycle that you've been going through, you start to see the power of it and the power of meditation, because it takes that mindfulness, that settled down mind, the mind that's also willing to examine how the mind is working, how these behaviors function, that you can interrupt this. You're not just doomed to be an automatic pilot for all of your life. Mary? This is going to be the last one, I think.
Bill, Annie, I love their topic. I love the talk tonight. Just loved it. Do you have any books that you recommend on dependent origination that are accessible?
There's quite a bit of material online. There is also a classic book by, I think, Paiuto. And I
thought that.
Okay, right. So that's a classic. Christina Feldman has a good short thing on that you can find online. In fact, if you Google dependent origination, you will see a bunch of good material. I don't know any other full-size books. There are other books that will have shorter treatments of them. I've read Dalai Lama in at least two of his books does treat it, but from a very Vajrayana viewpoint. So that's all I can recommend right now.
Okay. I've read Buddhadasa's book.
Oh, okay. I love Buddhadasa. I've not read that one, though.
Yeah. It's interesting, but it's quirky.
Buddhadasa is quirky, but I've learned a lot from reading some of his other books.
Oh, good. Thank you. I'll look online. That's great.